Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. We're a little more than 2 weeks from the midterms. I thought this is the perfect time for a self-aware episode on the topic of democracy. Today's guest is Shadi Hamid, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has a new book out, The Problem of Democracy, America, the Middle East, and the Rise and Fall of an Idea. Speaking of realignments, the significance of the word democracy has shifted over the past 20 years. It's gone from the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East to a ultra-fraught culture war term post-Trump. This conversation is focused on the intersection of democracy's challenge at home and abroad, informed by Shadi's focus on the Middle East. Before we get into the episode, I'd like to shout out our Supercast subscription offering. It's how we fund the show. If you particularly enjoyed this or any other episode of The Realignment, you can go to realignment.supercast.com or follow the link in the show notes on your podcast player to subscribe. Aside from supporting the show's work, you can also get access to Sagar and my bonus Ask Me Anything episodes. A huge shout out to the Realignment sponsor, Lincoln Network. Without any further ado, here's our conversation with Shadi Hamid. Shadi Hamid, welcome to The Realignment.
Hi, Marshall. Thanks for having me.
I spent some time prepping for this show because I think this is a fascinating topic. We're going to go democracy abroad, democracy at home. So I was trying to find the perfect opening question, and I decided I'm just going to cheat and ask you the book title. What is the problem with democracy in the context of your work?
Yeah, great question to start with. So for me, this is the fundamental question of our political moment, and it is the problem of democracy, so to speak, which is, what do we do when democracy produces bad outcomes? And usually when I say bad in this context, I use scare quotes, because part of the problem is we don't agree on what a bad outcome even it is. So people can say, well, good, bad, what if it leads to this? What if Trump wins? Yes, these are all concerns, but ultimately, we as Americans no longer have a shared sense of reality. So it becomes very difficult to define whether we like a particular outcome. But you can really kind of universalize this to other contexts in the Middle East, in Europe, with the rise of far right parties in countries like Italy and Sweden. This is becoming more and more of an issue, where we don't know how to react if a bad party or a bad individual comes to power through free elections. And the stakes seem very high, because often they are. And that is something that I think we have to get our heads around as American citizens, as American observers of our own politics, of the politics of other countries. This is going to be with us for the rest of our lives. This isn't something that, oh, we can just go back to normal, like once the Trump threat dissipates or Trump leaves the political scene. I think that people are a little bit naive to think that. There's something that has fundamentally changed about politics the world over, really, where it's no longer about economic divides. It's primarily about cultural, religious, identity divides. And those are much more difficult to resolve, because there's no way to split the middle on them, right? Because when you have marginal tax rates, people can, I suppose, get worked up about marginal tax rates, but at least there's numbers and you can like divide them or find like a middle ground between 30% and 40%. But how do you do that when the entire meaning of your nation is at stake, the future of the republic, the role of religion in public life? The founding even. I mean, the fact that we don't even agree on what the start date for our country is goes back to what I was saying earlier. Even on the most basic things, we don't have the same premises. And that means that, first of all, it means that we just have to like live, we have to live with that reality at some basic level and come to terms with that, that we're never going to return to a place of consensus and unity, those words that we hear all the time, and Americans like to pretend that this is possible, that we have to work towards unity. But in diverse countries, diverse societies, consensus isn't possible because people disagree on the fundamental questions.
Yeah, a lot of stuff I want to pick up there. Firstly, can you give some context for this? What did you mean by we can't even agree on when the country, quote unquote, started? Because I think most people would say, well, if the Constitutional Convention or maybe even 1776, like what do you mean by we can't decide like when our country started?
Oh, yeah, I suppose it's just a reference to the 1619 Project, but which is, you know, which is about actual specific dates. But it also gets to something deeper, which is I think more and more Americans are becoming ambivalent about the founding and what the founding meant. And obviously, that's fine when it comes to the practice and falling short of the stated ideals in the Declaration or the Constitution. But the fact now is that there are a growing number of Americans who don't really even believe in the American idea. And some of that has to do with how people conceptualize the early period of our country and how they make sense of it, you know, more than two centuries later. They take modern standards of what is right and good and superimpose them. And I think that creates a lot of contention about the American idea in a way that I don't remember that being the case when I was growing up. You know, we were Democrats, Republicans, we didn't like the other party, fine. But there was still a sense that everyone was within this American context, everyone was a fellow American, and that we shared a similar tradition. Like Mitt Romney might have been scary on certain things, but no one really questioned his commitment. Well, maybe some people did, but for the most part, the fear with Mitt Romney in 2012 wasn't the future of the Republic. It was that he would have bad economic policies and he was some kind of like neoliberal, like corporate goon or something. But those were the good old days, because it wasn't about the foundational questions the way that we're seeing now, where everything that we thought about the American idea, however we wish to define that, is being under serious scrutiny now. And that makes it hard to have a conversation because we're just starting from these completely divergent premises.
Something I'm interested in kind of zooming in on is, I read you had a great excerpt of the book in The Atlantic. We'll link to that in the show notes, of course. When you talk about what do we do when democracy gives a bad outcome, I think a good way of illustrating what you're meaning by that is, you know, you referenced in the piece like this idea of existential politics, in the sense that what do you do if the victory, or you perceive that the victory of the side opposite of you, puts your very existence under threat? And how, like, that dynamic specifically is one that feels new. There's been a debate about the New Deal. There's a debate about the Great Society. There's a huge debate over the war in Vietnam. And unless you're, you know, a male of draft age, that debate isn't going to feel existential in the way that people may feel today. And my take on your existential politics frame is it explains exactly why so many in the Never Trump, kind of like Liz Cheney, David French side of things, were particularly successful in beating back Trump. Because when politics is existential, it doesn't matter that Trump said, grab him by the pussy. It doesn't matter that Herschel Walker is obviously a terrible father who's almost certainly an extreme hypocrite when it comes to abortion policy. If it's the 1990s, it may make sense to get involved in that. But if you're a Republican voter, I don't care, because all I actually care is that you need a body in the seat to prevent the other side from defeating you at an existential level. So how do you think about how this frame introduces a new dynamic into American politics that's been difficult for, I think, status quo players to navigate?
I think you're exactly right. I mean, the basic dynamic now is we see folks from the other party not as the loyal opposition, not as adversaries. We see them as enemies to be defeated. And we're looking for a final victory in that regard. Even think about the kind of rhetoric that people have used for some time now about the permanent Democratic majority or the permanent, you know, Republican majority. This idea that one of the parties is going to be able to pull into the lead so significantly that they just simply won't lose elections on the national level. I mean, I get that people want their own side to win, but that's a very scary thought to me. And anyone who thinks to themselves, oh, I want a permanent Democratic majority, I think they should think twice about that, because part of what democracy is, if we look at the procedural aspects of it, is rotation of power. When you have, in effect, one party in power for decades on end, then you lose something important, in that respect, obviously. And I think also when people say things like, this is the most important election of our lifetime, and they say that with every election. So, I mean, is every election the most important election of our lifetime? And I get that people feel that way, but it's not a healthy way to enter into an election, because that's precisely what makes people so nervous and frightened about elections, because they're projecting a burden onto an election. If the future of the republic is at stake, then you have to do anything in your power to defeat the other side. It's not something that you can just, oh, well, they'll win this time and then we can fight back through the ballot box 4 years from now. People feel like it will change everything permanently. So, I mean, oftentimes what I say to people is, if I had one wish and I could just talk to every single American, the message would be, relatively simple, though it's hard to implement in practice, which is, I want every American to commit themselves privately and publicly and say that if you're a liberal or a Democrat and Trump wins in 2024, for me, that's kind of, God forbid, I really hope that doesn't happen. But if he wins freely and fairly and the result is clear, then we as folks on the left side of the spectrum will have to commit to respecting that outcome, as difficult as it may be, or if it's Ron DeSantis or whoever else. Similarly, though, and this is where I think Republicans are unfortunately pretty bad, I don't want to draw an equivalency. Democrats have their issues, obviously, but we do have an obvious case here of a large number of Republicans believing that the election was stolen. That's another example of not respecting a Democratic outcome if you perceive it as personally threatening or existential. So part of it is, we have to find a way to think about our fellow Americans not as enemies, but to transform them once again into the loyal opposition. And everyone, I think, has a role to play there. Of course, it's difficult.
It's interesting. I love thinking about this idea of final victory, because oftentimes and this actually tends to be a problem on the new right, folks who basically are articulating, this is kind of the Flight 93 election idea. This is the idea that you need this victory over your opponents. And, kind of to your point, you could kind of like besmirch that, but think back to even the past 50 years of American history. Like, Democrats controlled the House for 40 plus years. You obviously had a period of time where Republicans pretty much had a lock on the presidency. FDR and the New Deal did have a quote unquote final victory over the pre-New Deal conception of the role of government, the economic scope of what American power could look like domestically. And there's also some parts of that that apply abroad too. Then, of course, you could say that the Reagan Revolution like fundamentally pulled back for the next set of generations that limited government New Deal debate. So I guess it's hard to me, because you actually can kind of have final victories. So I guess kind of, what do you think of that term when you think about it that way?
Well, look, if there's a final victory in the sense of policy outcomes, so there's a set of policies associated with something like the New Deal, and if that is in fact a legitimate expression of the popular will, if that's what Americans seem to want and they vote for people who aren't trying to dismantle the New Deal, then that's a democratic outcome that you have to accept. So at some point there will be ideological victories of some sort where certain ideas went out, and that's fine. I think what's scarier is when people want a particular party, because that's not based on substantive content. It's based on just wanting your party to be in power by any means necessary, because you see the others as people who have to be vanquished, basically. So God, you know, I wouldn't like this outcome, but let's say a majority of Americans somehow got around the idea of like hyper wokeness culturally. And, you know, Republicans and folks like me who are, we're not Republicans, but are opposed to the woke turn in the Democratic Party. At some point, we would have to concede and say we weren't able to persuade our fellow Americans that wokeness is bad. And if they want to keep on voting for politicians who have these crazy ideas, well, we're going to have to live with it. But then we live to fight another day and we try to persuade them to change their mind. So I think that, so when I talk about the means versus outcomes, I think this is really important because I think we should see democracy in a more minimalist conception. So one thing that I talk about in the book is this idea of democratic minimalism. And it's a way of making democracy more realistic, more digestible, instead of putting this burden on it that democracy is supposed to lead to all of these other things that we like. So you'll often hear, you know, if we think that good things go together, right? And democracy is good. So therefore, if a democracy is working correctly, it should give us outcomes that we think are right. The right side of history, the arc of the moral universe bending towards justice, progress, all that sort of thing. But, and that could be racial equality, addressing economic inequality, expanding abortion rights. These are some of the things that folks on the left assume democracy will lead to. But what we're finding out is that when you give voters a chance to make their own decision, they often go in illiberal or non-liberal directions where they try to constrain aspects of individual freedom and autonomy and rights. And they go in a different direction. Italy and Sweden are the two most recent examples of this, where far right parties have risen significantly to the extent that Italy is likely to have a far right prime minister who will have been democratically elected and legitimate in that regard. So this kind of, we have to find a way to divorce the means of democracy from the ends. We as Americans will disagree on the ends. We want different things from our politics. But what I hope we could agree on is that democracy, even in this more minimalist sense, is a set of procedures that that allow us to regulate conflict. Because if we don't respect democratic outcomes, then we have no way of actually running government. I mean, how would that work? The only other option is coercion, the will to power, of seeking these final victories through non-democratic means, perhaps through violence. And if that's the alternative, I think the choice is clear.
You know, I'm curious, earlier in the recording, you've mentioned how you don't think consensus is possible. I'm curious how you get there, because from my perspective, I could say consensus in the big David McCullough greatest generation sense, that's probably a myth that was probably never real. But you have an issue like, let's say, China, where pretty rapidly and with democratic affirmation, you've had two polar opposite administrations, Trump and Biden, obviously come to a great accord when it comes to taking a more hawkish turn, the tech side of things, the economic policies, maintaining the tariffs, despite the fact that that was controversial at first. How do you really separate our ability to come to a consensus on a specific issue like that, as opposed to like a broader capital C consensus that means we have a stable society that feels chill, to say in a really colloquial way?
Yeah. So it is possible to have consensus, bipartisan consensus on specific policies as it relates to China and Russia. And that's been heartening to see. And actually, if you look at the congressional record during the Biden administration, it's been pretty productive in relative terms. I mean, if we look at the last 10 years, Congress has passed more major legislation in the last 2 years than in recent memory. And it has been often bipartisan. So that suggests that, you know, there are places where cooperation is possible. But it's interesting that those tend to be things when, confronting Russia, confronting China. And that, I think, those kinds of external threats superimpose a kind of consensus, because if it's us versus them, then, you know, it's clear which side we're on, and we're all Americans. So, you know, most Americans are going to share the perspective that China is potentially an existential threat to America's role in the world and the future of the American idea and democracy and so on. I think the danger is when you think that consensus is possible domestically, because then basically, if we're talking about cultural, religious, or identity-based issues, that there isn't a clear path to getting there, because there is no shared enemy that is going to get us to agree on abortion or the appropriate role of religion in public life. And why? Because our societies are increasingly diverse, ethnically, religiously, culturally. And this is where, you know, my experiences in the Middle East became really important for me. And I try to draw on those examples to make a broader point in the book about the democratic idea. But, you know, in the Middle East during the Arab Spring, there was no ability to get to consensus on these foundational questions. In the case of countries like Egypt and Tunisia, it had to do with the role of Islam in public life, the relationship between Islam and the state. The questions that people were asking were who we are questions. What does it mean to be Egyptian? What does it mean to be Tunisian? What is the nature of the state? What is the meaning of the state? And obviously, as we said, those are existential questions, right? And I thought that the Middle East was unique in that regard, because that was still during the Obama era, when we were debating kind of more policy-oriented things, universal healthcare, tax relief, deficit spending, and even things like Obama's tan suit. It seemed we weren't really debating the foundational questions. We were moving in that direction. We didn't realize where we were going. So I think that when you look at these divided societies in the Middle East, it gives you a certain insight into how difficult it is to get large numbers of people, tens of millions of people, if not more, to agree on the relationship of Islam and the state. How will you get Muslims to agree on that when you have different ideologies competing? Many Muslims in Egypt are religiously conservative and they want to implement aspects of Sharia in public life. Others are, especially on the elite level, you have a secular or liberal elite, which is very skeptical of this expanding role for Islam in public life. And they ended up seeing that as a threat, and they did not respect democratic outcomes. There was a military coup when an Islamist party came to power in Egypt. And I think in some ways, that period in the Middle East, which seemed really foreign, it was like a different world, a different region, of course, it offered a preview of what was to come in other electoral contests, even in advanced democracies. So in that way, I think the Middle East was ahead of its time. And anyone who says now that, oh, if we have to get to a consensus about Islam's place in public life, how are they going to do that? You have liberals, secularists, leftists, Islamists, ultra-conservative Islamists. You know, that is a fact of diversity, that people have different views on these issues that are very personal to them. Similarly, we as Americans have fundamentally different views on what it now means to be American. How are we going to transcend that? There's no obvious path that I can see where we return to that old consensus. And during the Cold War, we did have some at least appearance of consensus, but that goes back to the fact of having an external enemy. And maybe as China becomes more of a threat, you'll start to see some of the cultural divides at least becoming less intense. But I don't know if China is enough of an existential threat the way the Soviet Union was to really marshal that level of consensus.
Yeah, well, spend some time in the Middle East then. I'm curious then, you're pointing out that in a diverse society, let's say like in Egypt, you can't just say, this year we're going to figure out Islam's relationship with the state. That's not possible. But obviously, to some degree, eventually there will be some status quo there will be some resolution to that question. Maybe we'll move in one direction or the other, but it will kind of happen until eventually there will be some, I don't want to even say consensus, because consensus suggests that like if there's a happy medium, but how does that process work in Egypt, let's say, like starting in 2011?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it didn't work, and that was part of the problem. But the Muslim Brotherhood, the oldest, largest Islamist movement in the world, they did not only quite well, but they won to various degrees consecutive elections in 2011 and 2012 during the Arab Spring. And also ultra-conservative Islamists, the Salafis, did surprisingly well in Egypt's first democratic elections. They won 27% of the vote. You add that to the 41% or so that the Muslim Brotherhood got, and that's a pretty big slice for, you know, for Islamist parties, you know, around 70%. That freaked a lot of people out. And, you know, when I came back to the U.S. and I saw how people were freaking out to the election of Donald Trump, I did see some interesting cross-regional echoes. I've actually written about this. I actually, not to get like dramatic here, but I did a lot of liberals. I did cry on election night after Trump won. Me and my brother were talking and we were just worried about, my mom wears the headscarf, and we were worried about all the anti-Muslim sentiment that had been expressed, the Muslim ban, but even like, you know, Trump sort of talking about, you know, IDs for Muslims. He said such crazy things about Muslims during the campaign, and people tend to forget about that. And, you know, at some basic level, you worry about the safety and security of the people who are close to you, right? So, you know, in that sense, I get it when people freak out, because I freaked out. Luckily, I did find a way to chill, as you put it. But
Like operationalize for yourself? Like, how did you, you know what I mean? Like, what was that process? Because to your point, it's not as if we could go sit down to every single American and say, hey, like, regardless of what happens in 2024, let's continue moving on towards creating ever, you know, a perfect union. But what actually did it look like for you?
Well, okay. So one part of it, I talked to my dad because he had gone to sleep before the results were definitive. I talked to him the following morning. And me and my brother are freaking out. And our dad just kind of sits us down and talks sense. He's like, you know what? This is what people decided. That was the vote. And Shadi, you write a lot about democracy. And so, you know, don't freak out. There must be some wisdom in this. We can't see it. But if this is what Americans decided, then we have to kind of go with that and see where it goes and hope for the best. And you know, that kind of that to see that my dad and my parents just were not freaked out, even though they were the ones who potentially would be more noticeably Muslim or Arab. That was reassuring. And you just sometimes need people to talk perspective. And it did turn out that the 4 years of Trump were, in my view, not as bad as I feared. You know, when I thought about the worst case scenarios, those worst case scenarios did not really occur. And then Biden won. And I think there's a resilience there to the democratic idea that you, if you wait, you will have a chance to oust the person who won in the previous election. But, you know, on the bigger question of like, what does this actually look like? Because at some level, there has to be a settlement. And maybe that's a better word than consensus.
Mm-hmm.
So in a country like Egypt, I would hope that there can be a settlement where, well, it's hard to see what that looks like because, you know, after a military coup, after a democratic election, that kind of muddies the waters. It's hard to recover from that. And it can sometimes take countries decades to recover from an interruption, an extra legal interruption of the democratic process. That's why my view is you have to let the democratic process play out. If you're interfering in it or trying to suspend it in the view that this will be better, that you say you save democracy by ending it or something to that effect, which I think sometimes people find, like if you asked a lot of Americans, do you think that we should ban Donald Trump from running? Or do you think that we should if there was an ability to dissolve the Republican Party and ban it for anti-democratic activities. My guess is that a lot of folks would say to someone, you know, privately to a pollster, that's, you know, maybe we should consider that. Or in an ideal world, that would be nice.
Question on this. Wouldn't impeachment have been that banning? Like after January 6th. So what do you think about that question then?
Well, look, I think impeachment is a legal process. It's there in the constitutional framework. My concern is when you go outside the normal legal constitutional framework and you use extraordinary measures and, you know, however people want to imagine those scenarios. But even things that are in the Constitution, like the 25th Amendment, and you try to weaponize that, or you take a very narrow reading of it and you try to see if it can apply to someone like Donald Trump. Anything that is exceptional in that regard, you don't want to get yourself into a state of exception. You don't want to put a country on an emergency footing unless you really need to. And, you know, I don't think we've come anything close to that point. So there are things that would be legal or constitutional, but they would be used in a way that wouldn't really be, it would be about fighting your opponent. It would be like a this kind of different interpretation. So so that's what I would be most worried about. But if you're pursuing an impeachment process, that, you know, it's legal. It's something that's been done in the past. It's been used against Democrats. I don't think Republicans can say that it's truly exceptional in that regard. Is it the best use of time, you know, an impeachment process to do it the second time around with Donald Trump? You know, people can debate that. It doesn't, but we all knew that it wasn't actually going to lead to a definitive answer to the question of Trump.
Something I'm curious about, going back to the start of the show, you know, the books now has the, you know, the problem with democracy phrasing. And it feels like we're in this weird in-between spot when it comes to sort of critiquing democracy. So there's one side of the debate in U.S. foreign policy, for example. It's 2005. President Bush is giving an inaugural address where he firmly states that, like, the foreign policy, like, objective and orientation of the United States is, like, promoting democracy abroad, especially in the Middle East, obviously. We start to move away from that implicitly during the Obama administration and very clearly during the Trump era, and Biden in his own way with the Afghan withdrawal explicitly move away from that. At the same time, though, we're recording this coming out of the, you know, Chinese, you know, CCP Party Congress, Russia's struggles in Ukraine, and just Putin's inability to really demonstrate that his authoritarian model is at all something that people want to adopt throughout the world. Like, how would you compare democracy relative to its quote unquote competitors? I'm sure you're seeing there's a lot of funny Francis Fukuyama was right, but also, like, kind of seems like it was kind of true in the sense that this is a superior system in comparison to its challengers. So how would you really think about this?
Yeah. You know, we as Americans should believe in our own system. And that's why, look, the democracy is dying and declining. It's fine for people to be on edge and to try to reverse, you know, problematic developments in our political system. But when we get to the point where it almost approaches a certain kind of self-doubt or even self-hatred, that's when I get concerned, because for all of our faults, there's no equivalency as far, you know, from my perspective, between us and any authoritarian society or government. We are better than China. We are better than China, not because we're Americans. Well, that could be part of it, but also because of our system of government and the fact that, you know, we are free, open societies. And I think that even if you look at some of the depressing examples that people point to, let's say in Britain, where Liz Truss, failed and was ousted after 44 days. And, you know, Britain has had three prime ministers in a very short period of time. You know, there's one way to look at that and say, this shows that democracy is in crisis, that democracy isn't working. There's an alternative reading, which is, our democracies are alive. They are vibrant and vigorous. They are full of competition, debate, and people feeling strongly about things that are important to them. And if that means that, you know, a government falls and someone else is voted in or whatever it might be, or there's a leadership struggle in the Tory party, or in the case of Sweden, you have the far right Sweden Democrats being the largest party in the governing coalition, unprecedented. You can say, oh my God, the far right is in this unprecedented state of influence. Or you can say that democracy is doing its job because enough Swedes were not happy with the status quo, and they expressed that by voting for other parties. That is a signaling mechanism. It tells Swedish elites that a critical mass of voters are not comfortable with how things have turned out in recent years. You would think, hopefully, then, that these elites then use that information to reassess and to self-criticize and to think about how they can better persuade voters next time around. So that's the kind of mechanism that we should be proud of. And that is not a turnout. In a lot of these countries, we see very high levels of political engagement, very high levels of voter turnout. In our own last election, we saw high turnout. That is good. Americans are engaged. They're voting. We're going to see high voter turnout in the midterms coming up. That's good. So I think that, you know, it's sort of a half, you know, glass half full, half empty sort of thing. But I think we put ourselves at a certain kind of disservice if we're always saying, oh, we have to get our own house in order. We can criticize the Chinese for their one-man personalistic rule. No, actually, we can. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. So yes, we have our problems, but are you really trying to suggest that we have to wait till we solve our democracy, whatever that means, or resolve the problems of our democracy, and then and only then we can talk about China and how their system is corrupt and authoritarian? It's just a nonsensical approach, because I don't know if we'll ever resolve our problems. And that's part of what democracy is about. It's an ongoing process. And you never get to the point where you're 100% satisfied with the outcome. If you are too happy in a democracy, you're probably doing it wrong. So unhappiness and uncertainty is part of the package, because you shouldn't know how an election is going to turn out before it happens. That uncertainty is part of what makes democracy great. It's also part of what makes democracy so frightening. So for people to say, well, we want democracy to be less intense, less frightening, well, that would be nice, but democracy is going to have some level of discomfort that you're going to have to deal with. Again, not the easiest sell for everyone, because people want things, you know, Americans, we have these high expectations. We always want things to be better than they actually are. And we want democracy to be elegant and orderly and to have certainty. And we don't want to be, we don't want to wonder too much about what the outcomes are. But that's just a non-starter going forward.
You know, I really am happy that you articulated that dynamic around how a democratic system should course correct the way you did, because I think it gets to a core of comments that a previous guest made on the show, Tom Ricks. We had the episode on the civil rights movement. And he mentioned, I think it gets at the, you know, we focus on kind of like right-wing populist weaknesses. I think a real weakness you see in the center-left commentariat side is that they do what Tom did, which is Tom on the episode said, quote, 20% of America is white nationalist. Now, obviously, we could quibble about how you would get to that percentage, what that means, body, 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 blah. But the real takeaway that matters, given the framework that you just gave, and why I think that's a disastrous mentality, is the second you give that framework, it is impossible for you to take lessons from democratic pushback. So you wrote a great piece in The Atlantic about how Democrats need to actually address and handle crime. Now, if your framework for thinking about a possible red wave election is, holy crap, Obama and now Joe Biden have tried to move this country in a more democratic, more progressive direction, yet there are all of these like white nationalists or angry old white people who aren't able to see how the country is changing, they are reacting and they're going to go after us no matter what you do. Now, if that's your framework, then you can't address crime. You can't talk about crime because all you're actually doing is validating what you would interpret as like racist, dog whistle, you know, white flight backlash politics. So can you really talk about how, you know, the center left that you identify with should think about this dynamic without self-owning through delegitimizing your opponents in a way that's not going to be helpful? Because like the last thing I'll put in this is a critical thing that Democratic politicians are going to have to figure out coming out of this election is like, okay, the electors made clear that there are several issues they really care about. Energy, inflation, crime. They're not voting around the January 6th committee. How do we as a party come up with responses to those three issues? Saying only white nationalists fuel the backlash on those issues is the last thing you should be telling someone who's trying to confront them. How would you think about this dynamic?
Yeah, well, there's a definitional aspect. You know, 20% does seem a bit much to me. Unless one merely means by white nationalist, white people who are nationalist or nationalistic in some sense, which I don't think is how it's usually used. But even if you really thought that deep down, it would probably be better to not act in politics as if you believe that. Because once you go into it with that starting premise, you're going to just see. And if you think that 20% of your fellow Americans have this crazy racist ideology, you're going to be on the lookout for it. You will see it where it may not necessarily be. And this is where we have to also be aware of certain cognitive flaws in the human mind, confirmation bias, and how if we will something to be, it can be. If you really want to believe that there are 20% of Americans who are white nationalists, you can probably find some polling data that leads you in that direction. But if you're going into an electoral fight and you're thinking 20% of people have these terrible ideas, you're going to probably say some of the wrong things. You're probably going to see the other side as being somewhat deplorable, but also they are American citizens. So they are going to vote whether or not you like it. So I just think that it's just a better way to approach it, to think that, oh, well, I can actually maybe try to persuade that 5 or 10% or 20%, whoever they might be. That I think is a tactical argument, basically. But I think that the other danger is progressives have this issue where they believe in progress, as their name would suggest. And then anyone who blocks that progress then is put in a very odd category, because they're seen not just as being opponents in an election, they're also seen as people who are blocking the arc of history from progressing. Because if you believe that history moves in a particular direction, then you have to make sense of the fact of when it doesn't. So if Trump wins after history was progressing because Obama won and gay marriage was legalized, all these positive things are happening, then all of a sudden it's reversed. That reversal is a threat to everything you hold dear, but not just that. It's a threat to how you view history. And that, I think, that also raises the existential stakes. So we have to maybe question what we mean by progress, because good things don't always go together. So if you have a lot of one good thing, it may actually lead to some not great outcomes in another area. And to think that they're just a kind of solution that brings everything together, and that history will be on the right track. You just can't think like that, because that's not the way history moves. History is complicated. Things regress, or I shouldn't even use that term, because that would suggest that
there's a line.
Sort of like a linear aspect, yeah. And there isn't. So either we're all stuck in this kind of way of thinking things, and on crime, it's sort of like, well, we can't talk about crime because those talking points might empower Republicans, or it might weaken our own base. It's not about facts or truth. It's about doing whatever it takes to make sure that our own side wins. And look, if you're a Democratic operative, I suppose that would be the priority. But for the rest of us who are trying to analyze, observe, and understand, I think that, it's just not the right, it's not true, it's not right. I'm not sure if it's moral, because I don't think that lying about the truth or kind of turning a blind eye to reality is morally the right choice. And I think you see that Democrats are struggling in a number of places because they weren't willing to take some of these voter concerns seriously. And they would say things like, oh, well, the science says that crime isn't as big of a deal as you think, or that's not true. Basically, they're gaslighting voters and saying, you voters think that crime is worse, that it's getting bad in Philadelphia? Well, actually, if you look at the statistics, it's not as bad as you think. No one's going to respond positively to that kind of discourse. It's patronizing, and it is basically gaslighting, because you're telling people that what they see with their own eyes and what they can't trust their own eyes. And that's never a good position to be if you're trying to persuade people to vote for you, to kind of like basically treat them as if there's something wrong with them. And these kind of appeals to authority where you say, well, the experts say this, the science says this. So when people are wondering why are Republicans doing better in Oregon, for example, better than anyone would have expected.
Shadi, I have to fact check you. I am from Oregon. Oregon.
Oh my gosh.
I don't fact check, but I will fact check you on that one.
Oh wow, that was really bad. Thank you for correcting me on that. What are the chances that you're from there?
Yeah. Sorry, go on.
Yeah. So if Republicans are doing better, then there must be a reason that they're doing better in a particular state. They failed people in certain ways. People perceived it that way. And goes back to the course correction idea. There should be an option for the other party to win. And that means that the democratic process is working and voters are being responsive to new realities, even if we don't like the other party, right?
Yeah. So last few things. One, I want to highlight something from your Atlantic piece so we could try to move some subs here too, obviously. You really noted, did you ever do debate in high school or anything like that?
Yeah, I did. I was on the debate team.
Yeah, so was I. And I've noticed that there's this, and I can't prove this empirically, but I think there's this like toxic debate mentality that comes into actual political debate to the part where it causes fallacies like this. So you think of someone saying, well, actually, I have this trump card. We calculated that crime is actually X and you said it's Y. Therefore, you lose. You kind of treat this like it's like a trump card. Like, oh, I have my card in it. And the way this implemented itself is in the, because you reached out, I think this was to the Guardian, and you were looking at Philadelphia. And this was San Francisco. And if you looked at San Francisco, the claim was people think that Jason Boudin is like this huge issue, but actually crime is kind of like where it was pre-COVID. And the way that they got there was burglaries were up. But like other forms of crime, we're down. Therefore, if you add all of the crime together, it's all the same level. That's what kind of mean by like debate team mentality. And like, guys, like that's not the actual debate. Like the actual debate that people actually care about is, wow, like if you go to a CVS in San Francisco, you literally cannot get basically anything without an attendant because people will steal them off the shelves. Wow, burglaries are actually up. Like no one's debating, you know, specific like petty, I'm sure there are COVID related petty crimes that just didn't happen because people weren't leaving their homes as much. That wasn't the actual debate. So I wanted to pull out that example because I really felt what you were getting at. So for the last two questions here, number one, the key idea here is that it seems like you're pushing back against feelings in America that politics are existential because taking that to be true will lead our political system in a bad direction. But let's take some lessons from the Middle East. In the Middle East, in the way you've described it, politics actually are existential. If it's Iraq in 2007 and the Shia parties get take over the Interior Ministry, well, that means that you're going to have literal killings by, you know, Interior Security forces in the hospital. Like that is a desperately existential question. To your point about Egypt, there's a coup. That's existential. What lessons can we take from Middle Eastern democracies where these questions actually are existential for kind of dialing back our reaction or the mentalities here?
Great question. I mean, Well, I think one thing is we have to stop being narcissistic as Americans, where we always think the sky is falling and then we lose our global perspective. Because I think anyone who's spent time in the Middle East and seen what political conflict is there, it's silly then to kind of be in the U.S. and be like, oh, we're no longer a democracy, or we're becoming an authoritarian state because of voter suppression laws in Georgia. Those laws may very well be bad and make it harder for people to vote. But this idea of just dumbing things down so much that you almost disregard other people's experiences in other regions, I worry that there's almost something disrespectful about it. We want to feel a state of panic. I think people like to feel, maybe they don't like it because it's probably not good for their health and for their body, but I think people like the drive of feeling that they're in a revolutionary situation. That is, and then, you know, being in the Middle East in the Arab Spring, when you actually see a revolution, there is something thrilling about watching history unfold before your very eyes. But then there is a temptation to kind of like delusions of grandiosity, like, oh my God, we're going to fight even the resistance. I don't have a huge problem with it, but I do think it led to this idea. Wait, why are you in a resistance if you're in a democracy? You shouldn't be resisting. You should be trying to vote in the next elections and win and strengthen your party. It isn't about being in this revolutionary state. That's what happens in non-democratic contexts. I mean, resistance was used in the context of World War II. That's how a lot of us know the idea of being in the resistance, right? So kind of flattening time and geography to think that you can just apply these things in our own context. I think that in the case of, you know, it's interesting that, so in the Middle East, I think that to the extent that there is a solution, well, one part of the solution is to acknowledge that there is no solution and to have a kind of modesty about what is achievable in this world. Look, final victories, as we've talked about, I think they're more in the realm of the afterlife. When people think they could have that in the here and now, it's almost like they are usurping God's role. I mean, God, you know, not to get into like a religious digression here, but I think that there is something that feels disrespectful to the idea of God, to think that we can almost sort of, we can fast forward and reach the things that we shouldn't be able to reach as mere mortals. And that requires living with a kind of ambiguity. And I think in the Middle East, what that would look like, you asked, so if a consensus is impossible, what would a settlement look like? I think that I would have hoped to see secular or so-called liberal elites in a place like Egypt to just acknowledge that if it's in a religiously conservative society, if people have the right to vote, they are going to vote for parties that are more sympathetic to the idea that religion should play a prominent role in public life. That, I mean, there's just no way to get around it. There has to be some accommodation, because when you suppress things that a lot of people feel, that is not a permanent solution. And that's why autocratic regimes by their very nature are inherently unstable, because they try to suppress what is real and true in people's hearts and minds. And they use coercion to do that. So if it is in fact the case that a growing number of Americans, are becoming more nationalistic, whatever that means, then we probably shouldn't suppress that. We should try to make sure that there are ways to channel that desire or that political preference in the political process. We shouldn't demean or demonize and say these people have to be outside of the political process because they've crossed certain red lines. Now, there are a small number of Americans who may be beyond the pale. But my preference would be for those numbers. So let's say one approach to say 20% of Americans are beyond the pale, or 30 or 40, because Republicans, some people would say that by definition, if you vote for the Republican Party now, you are supporting the Trumpist Republican Party. And therefore, you're supporting all the things that he stands for, and that means you are a bad person. So some people might say that, you know, 40% of the country is beyond the pale, but then that's unsustainable. How is that going to work? You try to lower that number as much as you possibly can, and you try to extend the benefit of the doubt to your opponents so you can actually get that number down. So if someone is a proper white supremacist, and let's say that's 2% of the overall population who are like proper, like irredeemable, unreformable white supremacists, sure, people like Richard Spencer or whoever else it might be. But that requires like, you have to move in that direction, be willing to do that. And I think we've seen the risk of what happens in other regions of the world in non-advanced democracies when you start seeing your opponents as quite literally demons or people who will destroy you. It's very hard to get out of that mindset because that's a particular way of looking at the world around you. And once you orient yourself in that way, it's very hard to get back to a place where you can, as you put it, Marshall, chill.
Well, Shadi, could you shout the full book title out?
Yes.
People love to hear from the actual author. And then we'll close up the show. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Enjoyed this. So the title of the book is The Problem of Democracy, America, the Middle East, and the Rise and Fall of an Idea. It's a somewhat grandiose title, and I do acknowledge that. So The Problem of Democracy, I'm not going to claim that I solved it or that the book solves it, but, you know, we should give it our best shot.
No, it's like you said, I think the line, I was taking notes for the newsletter, and the line you used that was helpful here is just this idea of like the central question is like, what do you do when things feel existential? Because our current frameworks and models are not constructed for that. So exactly. I think that's very helpful. Shadi, thanks for joining us on The Realignment.
Thanks so much, Marshall.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the show of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.